Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian.
Hello, and welcome to a special edition of Tech Weekly, dedicated to the topic of education and technology, focusing on two innovators at the crossroads of teaching and computing.
The possibilities in terms of what the kids can do with technology, and because there's thousands of ideas, there's hundreds and thousands of ideas that kids have. The issue is, how do you give them the tools and the support so that they can get there?
In Rome, I met Carlos Contreras, Intel's U.S. head of education, to discuss his belief in software and systems that will prepare a generation for a technological future. And
I don't think there is any learning which is not e-learning. And will we learn throughout our lives? As long as we have a tablet phone, we are doing it all the time.
For Tech Weekly, Jason Phipps traveled to Newcastle to meet Dr. Sugata Mitra, recipient of the TEDx Prize and an innovator and educational researcher interested in the power of computing and self-learning in children. So, jackets off, copybooks out. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Intel has always been an innovative company, placing as much emphasis on hardware development as the research and initiatives that make their chips worthwhile and meaningful to their audiences. And one of those audiences is the education community. Carlos Contreras is the head of computer manufacturer Intel's U.S. education operations. I went to Rome to speak with the former teacher at Europe's first Maker Faire, only days after the announcement of Intel's partnership with microprocessing manufacturer Arduino. Now, lots of eyes are on maker systems like Arduino and the UK's homegrown Raspberry Pi to inspire kids into computing. And so I spoke with Carlos about what Intel's plans are in this regard and what steps they're taking to overcome stumbling blocks that might get in the way. Carlos, thank you very much for speaking with me in the middle of Europe's first Maker Faire. And you were saying that there's something like, you know, yesterday, on Saturday, there were 10,000 people. So it's been heaving.
Yes, we've had 10,000 people, kids everywhere. It's just been, the energy has been very intense.
And it's nice to see that there are, you know, that it's men, women, children, boys, girls, grannies, grandkids. It's you know, fun for the whole family, isn't it?
That's right. And that's really the intent of the event, is to have a lot of inclusion, have designers, artists, engineers, and the whole culture of the maker movement is to share.
So one of the big stories of the Maker Faire Europe here in Rome has been the announcement that Intel is Intel's announcement of the Galileo. And the Galileo, tell me a bit about it and why it's particularly interesting here at Maker Faire.
Yes, so we announced a couple things. One is we announced a collaboration with Arduino. Arduino is the leader in for the maker movement in terms of electronics. It's a very open source, open platform. So for non-engineers, people that are designers, people that want to create, it's a very friendly platform. And what we announced is a collaboration with Arduino, and we announced our first product with them called Galileo. And it's also has the first version of our processor, a Quark processor on Galileo. And it's compatible with Arduino, which means that people that are used to working with Arduino can now work with our board, and they can get the extension of the Intel technology.
This is a real vote of confidence then for the maker movement, for specifically Arduino, the brand. Why did Intel choose Arduino? Because there are other systems like Arduino out there.
No, that's right. I mean, we've been involved with the maker community for a couple of years from an education perspective, because we really like to your point about the inclusivity of it all, of the openness of it. And so we've been doing education work in terms of how do we get more kids interested in math, science, and engineering. And Arduino has a leadership role with the community. It has a very strong community base of supporters, people that like to share what they built, and they share code and they help each other. And so we want to be part of that. We want to be part of that, and we should be part of that. It's terrific.
Also, Arduino really over the last maybe 5 or 6 years, maybe even a bit longer, has kind of risen to the top, hasn't it? At which, in addition to the community that who would gladly purchase a Galileo just to sort of fiddle around with it and see what it does, you've also got a code base. You've got libraries and libraries that you can already build on, don't you?
That's right. So that's really the beauty of think of the collaboration. So what we bring to the table is that bridge. Right, for these designers that are used to Arduino, now we have a bridge to the Intel technology and we have a bridge to the Intel ecosystem. From a commercial perspective, that's very exciting for them because they can really they have access to more tools, more development opportunities, and they can really scale.
I was actually going to ask specifically because I've got quite a lot of Arduinos at home. My partner is a maker, and we've done projects together using Arduinos. And, you know, projects using Arduinos are far and wide. It's not just building robots or machines that will move around. You know, what we were playing around with is a philosophical conceptual art piece, ultimately. So you can do all kinds of things with Arduinos. He's coming here to basically to look at the new Arduino, which is not the Intel-related Arduino. So why should he buy? Because that's Wi-Fi compatible and got all kinds of things. So why should he look at the Galileo instead of, I believe it's called the new?
That's right. I think that's a very good question. One of the things that our Galileo board offers is it has a lot more flexibility. It's got a lot more ports. And it also has the Linux compatibility. So that, again, it opens up a whole library and then a whole other ecosystem for builders. And so we're excited, and this is the first product. The other thing we announced with Arduino is we're going to do multiple boards. And so we're already hearing feedback. We passed out over 1,500 boards here with the community. People are coming up to us already with things that they built, and they're already coming up with us with suggestions in terms of things that they would like to see. So that's, for us, that's really the exciting part of it too, is this is the first foothold. We're going to keep improving. We're going to keep getting better because that's what we're all about.
And that certainly is what you're all about when it comes to education. You know, the buzzword at the moment, or the buzz product, I suppose, at the moment in the UK is the Raspberry Pi, which has been enormous in terms of its popularity in schools. I think even to the surprise of the creators of the Raspberry Pi. Why did you not team up with Raspberry Pi?
Well, I think what we saw was the Arduino community for us was very attractive. So for the last couple of years, we've been looking at them, and we see a lot of projects already at the high school level, even at the lower level with kids. And so everybody in the States, I'm sure the UK is the same way. There's a big problem of how do we get more computer engineers? How do we get more computer scientists? I think in the States, we focus very hard on kind of the high school level computer science classes, and it's too late by then, because then kids have selected. And so you're not really doing anything at that point in time. And what we want to do is reach kids that are younger. And having an Arduino compatible platform, to your point earlier about you can create just about anything, is very flexible. And that really engages kids, because then you start engaging kids with the end result instead of engaging kids with you have to learn X, Y, and Z before you get to the end. And that's where I think we lose a lot of kids. Because they just don't have an idea of why am I learning this? What's the usefulness of it? Now you start with what do you want to make? What do you want to create? And how do you get there? Which is a very different process for kids. And that builds intrinsic motivation for the kids to really overcome all these little barriers that they have to overcome if they want to design their idea.
Over the last week, even, there's been quite a lot of debate about bringing coding into schools. You know, there's some real proponents who say, here is the evidence. If you get kids coding earlier, then you get more coders, or you get more people, whether it's girls or boys, interested in STEM subjects. But then on the other side, you have people who are saying, well, hold on a minute. We're actually locking them into a way of thinking. We're locking them into a kind of a process, a logic, a philosophy that doesn't necessarily open them up into different subjects. Obviously, you work for a computing hardware company and you're the education guy. So I can imagine you're certainly on the side of those who say get kids coding early. But what do you say to those who say, hold on a minute, maybe we shouldn't get kids in front of computers that early?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at our programs, right, the two major programs that we have for Intel is one is for teachers, Intel Teach. We've trained over 11 million teachers, and that is all about how do you build these 21st century skills for kids, the collaboration, the problem solving. So it has nothing to do with technology. It just has to do with really good thinking skills and really the skill sets that kids need. And then on the other side, we have Intel ICEF, which is the International Science and Engineering Fair. It's a high school science fair competition. And there you see biology, cancer curing, engineering projects, psychology projects. I mean, it runs the gamut of the sciences and the engineering. And so we're not a one trick pony in terms of it's only about computing. It's really about driving interest in the sciences and engineering. And the way you get there is you have to engage kids where they're at. And so the one size fits all approach is not going to work with kids. You're going to reach a very small amount of kids, but the majority of kids really want to learn what they want to learn. And you have to be able to figure out a way of how do you give them a platform so that you can engage them.
As a kid who a grown up kid, I like to think, but as a grown up kid who learned very early because I had my hands on, you know, DOS machines and everything. Like I learned what was under the hood, yes, as they say. Yeah. But I can imagine that, you know, with the dawn of really beautiful interfaces, with the dawn of, you know, just click here and it takes you to there, the mystique of what's under the hood, it's not even the mystique, but simply the practical use of what's under the hood has disappeared. Even with apps, you know, you get a very specialist group of people who are building those things for the masses who just simply want to touch a screen. So how can you, if your approach actually is to give kids the end product and say, okay, this is what you want, how do you then get them to take a step back and say, okay, how do I build that? Where do I go from there?
No, that's a really good point. I have the same background as you. My dad was an engineer. I have two brothers who are engineers. He had a lab. And so we just messed around with stuff. And so it was always the tools were friendly. And I think that's the key, right? Is how do you make the tools friendly for the kids? And again, this collaboration with Arduino and the Galileo board, that's what we're going to go after, is how do we make it a flexible tool and an easy tool so that you can engage kids and you can engage them in a way, and teachers, because teachers are extremely important in the process. I want to make sure that that comes across.
Well, undoubtedly, because the teachers are the ones who can help them to translate it. Otherwise, you know, if you don't have people who are implementing it, then the kids won't actually know how to get there in the end.
Exactly. And you know, kids will get stuck, and teachers provide such wonderful context and such wonderful insights in terms of what's needed and how do you get kids to the next level.
The movement, at least in the UK over the last maybe decade, and it's been controversial, is this idea of personalized learning, how you incorporate the different ways that kids with different approaches can solve problems, how they can come to solutions, how they themselves can learn in a way that works for themselves. Now, in the US, it's a slightly different system because you've got individual school districts, et cetera. But can you tell me a little bit about how personalized learning works with, you know, with the Galileo idea, and also with the international and the US-based training programs that you run?
Yeah, so, at the end of the day, the personalization is really going to be up to how well your teacher does this, right? And so at the formal sector, if you look at the formal sector in terms of K-12, the schools, you have to give teachers the tools. You have to give parents the tools, which means that a lot of the personalization, you need very good, for example, assessment tools, right? Things that can tell teachers where kids are getting stuck, what's the interventions that they need, and just getting them through to the next level. And we're starting to see a lot of really interesting tools come out of that. You don't want to test the kids to death, of course. Nobody wants that. But you need data and you need information, and teachers need that information and parents need that information so they can provide the best thing for their kids. The one move in the States that we've seen in this direction is around once you master a subject, you move on. mastery when you move on. So you don't have to sit there and wait until everybody catches up to you, or if you're struggling, the class will pass you by. And so how do you make it so that when you reach the skill, you can move on to the next level? And there's a lot of tools like the Flipped Classroom, right, that are doing these types of things. And so that is, I think you're going to see more of that as the tools get smarter, as they get cheaper, and as they get more friendlier to teachers and parents.
A friend of mine worked at a big bank in the UK. And she was one of the networking people. And she was constantly having to train just because that was her job. And it moved beyond turn it off and on again, right? She had to know intimately the technology that she was using to make the bank and all the infrastructure function. When you're introducing lots and lots of new technology, when you're introducing lots of new platforms, you're going to freak a lot of teachers out, aren't you? How do you make sure that the teachers are on board and that they're able to master the tech?
That's right. That's for us, right? The worst thing you can do to a school is to give them devices without any training. I mean, that is an absolute waste of money because the teachers need training. They need to be able to change how they work, and they need to be able to incorporate their existing tools that they have that have been successful with the technology. And that's really the whole point behind our Intel Teach program, because it's really a teaching, how do you teach better class? It's not about how do you use technology, how do you use Excel? It's really about how can technology help you as a teacher develop these critical skills that students need.
It really has, it's moved beyond sitting me down in fourth grade in front of an Apple II or whatever it was at that point and saying, push these buttons. The classroom of today is so phenomenally transformed. Phenomenally. It's a completely different beast now. And that is quite intimidating for any grade school teacher who's teaching a whole variety of classes of subjects that they might, they may have a handle on one, they may not have a handle on another. And so I can see why the technologies would help them come to terms with that knowledge themselves and help them to teach their students that. If we fast forward to the Galileo Arduino enhanced classroom of the future, right? Let's look a little bit in the future. How can you give me, in your creative brain, can you give me examples of how an Arduino, how a Galileo Intel processor board would be used to teach all the different school subjects?
Sure. I'll give you an example of a particular student in the States. Her name's Sylvia Todd. She goes by Super Awesome Sylvia, right? She has a web show that she broadcasts where she shows you different things that she's made. She has thousands of hits on those shows. And then a couple months ago, she had a Kickstarter project, she calls it a color bot, right? So this student, I believe she's 12. She started making when she was about 8 years old. She was embedded within the maker community, and so she's built up her skills, and she was sharing her ideas as she went along, which made her stronger, which then gives her an opportunity to grow even more. And now she's an entrepreneur, right? And so the possibilities in terms of what kids can do with technology, that's one of the reasons we want to be in there is how do we give kids that opportunity for them to do those types of things like Sylvia has been able to do, because there's thousands of ideas, there's hundreds and thousands of ideas that kids have. The issue is, how do you give them the tools and the support so that they can get there?
A huge thanks to Carlos Contreras. And for links to Intel's educational projects, just visit the blog for this podcast, theguardian.com/techweekly.
I wanted to test the limits of this system. The first experiment I did out of Newcastle was actually done in India, and I set myself an impossible target. Can Tamil-speaking 12-year-old children in a South Indian village teach themselves biotechnology in English on their own? And I thought, I'll test them, they'll get a zero. I'll give them material, I'll come back and test them, they'll get another zero. I'll go back and say, yes, we need teachers for certain things. I called in 26 children. They all came in there. I told them, look, there's some really difficult stuff on this computer. I wouldn't be surprised if you didn't understand anything. It's all in English, and I'm going. So I left them with it. I came back after 2 months, and the 26 children marched in looking very, very quiet. I said, well, did you look at any of the stuff? They said, yes, we did. Did you understand anything? No, nothing. So I said, well, how long did you practice on it before you decided that you understood nothing? They said, we look at it every day. So I said, for 2 months you were looking at stuff you didn't understand. So a 12-year-old girl raises her hand and says, literally, apart from the fact that improper replication of the DNA molecule causes genetic disease, we've understood nothing else.
You've just heard a clip from one of the most inspiring TED Talks on the web. Dr. Sugatra Mitra is a computer scientist from India, and in a fit of curiosity, he decided to knock a hole in the wall of his Delhi office and fit a simple, robust PC facing out onto what was a slum. He then documented the unsupervised use of the computer by the children, and what he discovered was astonishing. Children need very little to reach a high level of computing skill other than access to a computer, a healthy group dynamic amongst the children themselves, and, to a great extent, the grown-ups to leave them alone. His observations and subsequent research into children and self-learning led to receiving the TEDx Prize and an offer from the University of Newcastle to continue his research in the UK. At the recent British Science Festival in Newcastle, Jason Phipps met up with Dr. Mitra to find out about an extension of his ideas formed in the slums and villages of his native India, and his latest project, which he calls School in the Cloud.
The first thing I did when I came into Newcastle 7 years ago from far away was to try and understand the city and to understand its history. And then I ran into this rich heritage of technology and of leadership in many different areas of Lord Armstrong and the way. And I naturally got curious about, so where does this thinking come from? And that would lead us into the way in which children were educated in that time. For a while it would appear that if we could go back there, then we would get something good. But I quickly realized that that's never a solution in history. There is never a time to which you can return and expect that things will be wonderful because things change. So the Victorian system was created at a time when there were no telephones. There was books were expensive. Knowledge resided in individual minds. So what choice was there but to say, if you know something, you tell it to me, you describe it to me, and I will learn it from you. As books started to proliferate, that statement would change. That statement would then say, well, even if you don't know all of it, can you tell me what books I can read so that I can learn this? And having read those books, you would say, are there any other books that you would recommend? And then comes the internet. The internet is different from books because books don't talk about themselves and they don't talk about other books. The internet talks about itself and it points to other pieces of information point to other pieces of information. It's all linked up together. So now you don't need the wise man and you don't need the guide either. What you need is access. So it was kind of natural for me to walk into a gate-set school and say, what will happen if I give them access? And obviously in the developed world, access is denied purposefully. It's not as though you don't have the internet, like in India in many cases, they don't have electricity or whatever. But here it is purposefully taken away from the child. And the child is told, put away all your devices and walk into school. Use only your mind. In other words, send him back into the 19th century for 6 hours a day. That seems a bit pointless.
Most people, when they say they've got soul, means something slightly different. But with you, basically, soul is a form of independent learning. It's a system that you've observed through doing what you're doing. Could you tell us what soul is?
A SOL stands for a self-organized learning environment, but I must make it very clear that the word self-organized is used in the scientific, technical sense. A self-organizing system is actually a term used by mathematicians and physicists to describe systems where behavior happens by itself. So it should not be interpreted as organization of the self. A self-organizing system is a self-organizing system. So it's often also called chaotic systems. So what happens inside these souls, these self-organized learning environments, is that the children are free to get into a chaotic state. Now that might sound terrible coming from a teacher, that you know they're running about and talking and doing whatever they feel like on a computer and so on and so forth. But there is an overarching question which is left behind for them if they wish to deal with it. And in my experience, 8 to 12-year-olds will invariably come back to engaging with that question simply because they have the confidence that they can find the answer, and they know that if they find the answer, I will be very impressed. So just to show off, they will come back to that question. The chaotic situation then produces emergent order. And I think that there is something very fundamental about the nature of learning in this whole process.
And there's something very specific about the internet and technology, in a sense, where a child's confidence and basic wonder and belief in the machine, in the technology, is sort of reinforced by the internet's neutral provision of information, i.e., unlike a human and unlike a teacher, it does not prejudge. It has no prejudgment in a way. It provides the information neutrally, and that in a way enables a greater confidence amongst children. Is that what you've observed?
Yes, but I have a very important proviso to add to this. The internet is non-judgmental about what it's giving. There could be people's opinions on it. There could be all sorts of things on it. A single child left alone with the internet could take the wrong road. So in a soul, in that chaotic environment, the number of computers has to be strictly far fewer than the number of children. This causes the children to flock around computers. When they flock, and I've heard this over and over again, a child will say to another one, "Don't look at that one, that's rubbish. Look at the other one, it has fewer words, but it's saying the right thing." They learn to discriminate. And I think that as a 21st century skill, that learning to discriminate between what is rubbish and what is not is far more important than learning the 17 times tables. Being able to discern what they're reading. And again, I come back to thinking together with other people. The old system often prepares us purposefully to solve every problem by yourself alone. And I think that also has to do with the military past from which it came. If you are in a trench with a rifle, you have to solve all your problems on your own. I hope we are not preparing our children for that eventuality, because we should not have people in trenches with rifles. We should instead have young entrepreneurs sitting around a table and inventing and creating new things.
And that collective, collaborative thing, I mean, obviously the internet is fantastic for that. And say specifically with Skype, with Google Plus and Google Hangouts now evolving as a very, very effective form of video conferencing. These things are becoming a greater part of a lot of workplaces, never mind education. In other words, these technologies will be in the workplace before, you know, when the children get there. So I take it building a skill to integrate that into learning is vital to go on and become a kind of productive person in the economy.
Oh, absolutely. And there is a strange dichotomy in our schooling system. The schooling system is geared towards your clearing eventually the GCSE A level examination, where your instructions are: put away all your devices, do not look right or left at anybody else, and answer these questions using only your brain, paper, and pencil. After you finish GCSE and come out of school, you join your first job, the first thing your boss says, call a meeting, get your friends together, look it up on the internet, and tell me properly what the problem is. So you're told to do exactly the opposite of what you were taught for all those years in school. So I don't understand why we can't see that children can detect this dichotomy. And therefore, they say, and they're now increasingly saying, what is this for? I don't want to go to school because I don't think anything useful is happening there.
Okay, well, a lot of people have seen your vision. TEDx have given you a grant to realize the School in the Cloud project. Can you just tell us a little bit about that? You're going to establish these, like you describe them, I think, as cyber cafes for children. But I think it's a much more interesting architectural proposition. It's a sort of a hub, some sort of pod of communication that doesn't disrupt this chaos, this creative chaos. Is that correct?
Yes, that is what I am trying to create. Still don't have the whole design done. It's still sort of partly in my mind and so on. But its origins of these schools in the cloud, as they're called, comes from two or three things that we know and two or three things that we don't know. The things that we know, which I know from many years of work, is that groups of children can teach themselves to use the internet. We have ample evidence. We know that children can learn to discriminate between what is good and bad if you allow them to work in groups. We know that teachers, really good quality teachers, can be Skyped in. And they, children who don't have access to good teachers can have access to the very best for free. We know these things. What we don't know are two very important questions. Can children learn to read by themselves? This is very critical because this whole process of the soul depends on reading and reading well. Can that happen by itself or does it have to be taught? The second thing we don't know is, can children learn to search accurately using the internet so that they don't fall into the trap of going the wrong way? I know that, as I said earlier, that if they're working in groups, then the chances of their not making a mistake is much higher. But having said that, nevertheless, they could get led astray even as a group, you know, if they're really little or something like that. So do we need teachers for this or not? So then if you take the first three known things, I can put them together and I can build this pod where this creative chaos produces emergent order. I know that that bit will happen. And in that process, in these 3 years, I want to answer the two unknowns. Will they learn to read by themselves? And will they learn to search by themselves? If they can do those two things, it's really the end of schooling as we know it.
Yeah, a lot of people say that you're anti-teacher, but that you're not. You're obviously, you've been a teacher most of your life. You're a computer science teacher. And actually, we're physically in a space that I, as you describe your vision, thought might be very sort of similar to what you're trying to describe. We actually have a sort of a computer screen next to us. It's a pod. You can actually hear the slightly strange acoustic because we have a kind of clear perspex circle. We could actually open the door. Hang on, I'll just open the door like that. And you can hear the outside and then we close it. It's got different light settings. And it actually, I think in a way, oddly, is kind of an architectural space that might work. Obviously for children it might have to be redeveloped, and I'm not sure you need seats and stuff like that. I mean, the origins of your project was facing a computer onto a street in a slum for children, and weirdly a lot of people might have obsessed about the computer, but the street, I think from my observations, played as a very key role where it allowed for that chaos. In fact, a lot of things that we think are disturbing educationally, we need quiet environments, people can't pass by, you can't have random forming groups and then breaking up and groups reforming teachers, like even if they work in groups, to set the group. That didn't exist at all on the street in your original project and seemed to be sort of almost key to the sort of incidental learning and sharing of knowledge as kids came in and left the group and came back in.
Well, I mean, that's very perceptive of you. And there is a friend of mine in India who is actually experimenting with this right now. And she had exactly the same thing to say. She worked with souls for a while in enclosed environments. And then she wrote to me and said, you know, this is not the hole in the wall. The hole in the wall was different because people could come and go as they please. They could cluster as they please. Nobody said you have to be here for half an hour or 3 hours. So what I said to her was, in that case, we have to convert the soul into a hole in the wall, but enclosed. And that's from where the school in the cloud idea came, where you would have spaces, but children are free to move in and out of those spaces. And in any case, there is no supervision apart from one adult who may be an illiterate adult whose job is to just maintain health and safety norms. Mm-hmm. So given that, can I replicate those qualities of the hole in the wall which otherwise would be missing in a more structured environment? Similarly for groups, I used to make a mistake until another friend of mine pointed out. I used to say to the children, okay, here's this question. I wonder what the answer might be. So why don't you get into groups and try it? This friend of mine said, you said it's a self-organizing system. So I said, yeah. He said, then why do you say make yourselves into groups? What if they don't want to? So I stopped doing that. And then I noticed that, well, if the number of computers is less than the number of children, they will anyway form groups. But they don't form necessarily groups of four. Sometimes they form groups of 16 because one particular child has found something really interesting. So everybody clusters. And then they decluster and go back to other computers and chase the idea forward. So it's a delicate concept. And even I, who started it, make these obvious mistakes.
Mm-hmm. You've seemed to be slightly ahead of the curve, and e-learning and the internet as a really sort of a powerful engine in education is happening around us as we speak. EdX is a fantastic project between MIT and Harvard. We have things like Coursera. Mendeley is obviously a powerful sort of social stroke academic platform. These things, these chaotic things are starting to sort of organize and become very powerful. Do you believe there's no really return? I mean, I'm not even asking you a question. I think I'm saying to you, really, there's no return. This is coming down the line. How prepared are we for this?
Well, we are struggling with it. By we, I mean the adult world, because there are words which are actually becoming obsolete within months of being created. So according to me, words like e-learning and lifelong learning are both obsolete words, and people still have conferences about them. But I don't think there is any learning which is not e-learning. And will we learn throughout our lives? As long as we have a tablet phone, we are doing it all the time. Okay. So the generation which has never seen a world without a tablet phone is certainly going to be lifelong learners, and they're certainly going to be e-learners. So that's not what this is all about. The idea is that, like the imaginary Greek creation called the Oracle of Delphi, we've actually gone and made it. And it's there. And we don't need almost anything else, really.
Dr. Mitra, thank you so much for coming on Tech Weekly, and good luck with the project. And we'll look forward to hearing about it in the next couple of years when you've got lots of data sets and you can tell us exactly what you found.
Well, thank you, and I hope you wish me luck.
For links to Dr. Mitra's School in the Cloud project, just go to our blog, theguardian.com/techweekly. That's it for this week. Our focus on education and technology continues on the website, theguardian.com/tech. But for now, from me, Alex Kratosky in New Orleans, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.